as much of the frozen lake as possible, before being forced to angle westward, to a spot marked on an old map that none of them knew whether to trust. With each frozen, weary step, Anise wondered more and more whether she was leading them on a fool's mission. "We have no other option," she reminded herself. "War is coming, and we have no army. I have to give my people a chance to defend themselves. Risking my life, the life of my brother, and the lives of these two knights, is the price of hope." Still, doubt kept in, day by day, night by night. Then something changed. "What is that?" Archer said, his voice muffled through his scarf. Anise looked at him. He was pointing into the distance. She followed his gaze. Something sparkled, shifted, flowed. "Is that?" Her question trailed away, because it was impossible. This far north, in the dead of winter, it was impossible. And yet... "Water," Dietrich said. The moment he uttered the word, the ice beneath his feet began to crack. 24. The Northern Kingdom, Darin. Tarin Shiri. Tarin froze mid-step, dread coiling through his gut. Anise! Inexplicably, impossibly, he knew she was in mortal danger. Fay, always by his side, always supporting, stopped too. "Tarin?" she said. He didn't see her, didn't hear her, as he whirled around, scanning the flat, empty expanse separating the castle of Darin from both the Mournful Mountains and the Razor, half expecting to find Anise standing there, surrounded by enemies. Wind whipped across the barren snowfields. The snow had been falling continuously since it started, garbing Darin in a thick, white coat. Hundreds of soldiers were working hard, as they had been for several days, digging pits, lining them with spikes, covering them with flimsy branches and snow, smoothing them out. Others built walls at odd angles, wrapping them with coils of spiked metal wire. Those not digging or building drilled with Sir Jonathan nearby. None of it was done to Tarin's standards, the way it would have been if he had a platoon of seasoned soldiers. But it would have to be enough. It had to be. But that was the last thing on Tarin's mind at this moment, the fear lingering, clinging to him like a thick fog.
"Tarin,"
Fay said again.
"What is it? What's wrong?"
Tarin didn't look at her, chewing his bottom lip as he tried to decide how to explain the unexplainable.
"She'll think me paranoid," he thought. "And maybe I am. No."
A voice hissed from the deepest, darkest recesses of his mind. Tarin cringed. For the last few days he'd avoided that voice, that thing inside him, by moving, working from dawn till dusk, throwing himself into each task with a furious fervor none of his men could come close to matching. He barely stopped to sleep, eat, and relieve himself, and even when he did, he kept his mind focused on anything and everything but the monster in his core. But now...
"What do you mean, no?"
Tarin thought back. He was distantly aware of Fay grabbing his arm and trying to force him to look at her, but he shrugged her off, focusing, focusing, focusing.
"I mean you're not going mad. I mean Anise is in danger." "Shut your filthy mouth!"
Tarin snapped back.
"You don't know that. You can't. You are connected to her now. A part of me is in her. In Castle Hill, on the battlefield, your blood mixed with hers. What? No. What have I done?"
he thought, feeling ill in the core of his being. Could his curse truly be spread so easily? Would her blood turn black? Would fire and bloodlust war inside her heart? He'd left to protect her, but that meant that he couldn't protect her from any other dangers. Which was worse? It was an impossible decision, but he'd made the only choice he thought he had at the time. But if he'd left a part of the monster inside of her, if anything happened to the one person that mattered the most to him in this world, Tarin knew he couldn't live with himself.
If you hurt her, he thought, leaving the threat unfinished.
The monster had the nerve to laugh, boiling Terin's blood in the process.
Your anger is misplaced. She isn't like us. I can't change her the way I can you. I can only feel what she feels. This is my gift to you.
Which brought everything full circle, to that feeling of dread, the danger she was in.
I have to go, Terin said. I have to find her.
Fay grabbed his face on both sides, forcing him to look at her.
I don't know what war you are fighting in your own head, but you must focus. You are here. You are the Lord Commander. These men need you. Everything falls apart without you.
Terin felt like everything was falling apart anyway, like chunks of him were being ripped off by birds. He couldn't get his breath, couldn't find the air, his chest sucked in, gasping, gasping. Fay hit him hard, and the monster responded, snarling from the back of his throat.
Better, Fay said. You'll need that anger when you face your enemies.
Terin threw his shovel down. The last pit was finished. Several men skittered past him, sliding ladders into the hole, dropping sharpened wooden poles that would be shoved into the ground, business end facing up. Others hauled thin branches to thread across the gap, which would then be covered with snow. They were crude traps, Terin knew, but anything to slow the enemy down was worth the time and effort. From there Terin strode to the wall builders, crouching to lift a large tree trunk stripped of branches and bark. Other similar trees were being lifted and carried by teams of half a dozen men. Terin grunted, relishing the burn in his legs, the slight ache in his back, the flex of his biceps and chest. His anger had burned out long ago, but still he toiled alongside his men, even as the shadows lengthened and the sun dipped precariously toward the top of the razor. Balancing the tree on his massive shoulder while he waited his turn, Terin considered their chances. If the Easterners came with less than 500, thinking their enemy was weak and ill-prepared, perhaps they could put up a fight. But if their enemy brought a force greater than that? He didn't want to think about it. All he could do was prepare them the best he could, both physically and mentally. He needed them to believe they could seize victory, even if everything else pointed to the opposite. And he needed them to be able to stuff their fear and doubt into a place where they wouldn't see it.
Maybe you should do the same, he thought,
slinging his trunk down onto the half-finished barrier of wood and mud and mortar.
Anise is fine.
He clung to that belief, because he would know if she was dead, wouldn't he? If what the monster inside him said was true, and he believed it was, for the monster had never lied to him, then he would know without a shadow of a doubt the moment she passed from this world and into whatever came next. And he hadn't felt that, even as the feeling of dread lingered all day while he tried to distract himself from it by working his body to its fullest. He wasn't scared for her, not anymore, because she was the strongest woman he knew, a fighter, a survivor, and he believed that whatever she faced now, she would prevail. She would conquer.
And so shall you,
the voice hissed, slithering from whatever hole in his soul it had been hiding in. 25. The Hinterlands. Anise Garrick. Before their eyes, the ice began to shred, cracks forming like spiderwebs, radiating outwards at an alarming rate. The ice beneath Anise's feet wobbled slightly, and she was forced to drop to a knee to keep from falling. Archer, his eyes, wide brown orbs, said,
"Anise, you have to get off the ice."
She heard the meaning in his tone. "You first. Only one can move at a time, or we're all getting wet."
"He's right,"
Sir Jonius said, his teeth locked. His arms were out to maintain his balance as the ice continued to shift below. "Brute strength and queens before beauty and finesse," Sir Dietrich said. In any other situation, Anise would have thrown something at the knight for such a remark, but right now she feared the slightest twitch would shatter the ground.
"We go together," Anise said.
There was no time to even contemplate how the ice was cracking. The air temperature had only gotten colder as they'd travelled north. If anything, the ice should be thicker, stronger.
No, Art said. You are the hell-frozen queen, and you will get to safety.
I am the hell-frozen queen, and I command you all to go together, she growled back.
Damn these chivalrous men and their honour.
We'll move apart, keep our weight spread out. Dietrich left, Jonius right, Arch straight down the centre.
And what about you? Art said.
I'll head even further south, where the ice should be thicker.
Like you said, I'm the queen and I should get special treatment.
She forced a grin onto her face.
Now move!
They looked unconvinced, but obeyed. Arch, with his usual grace, practically danced across the ice on his tiptoes. The ice groaned with the first two steps, but then he passed the point of true danger, flashing a smile behind him as he made for shore. Dietrich had little trouble, too, his movements agile and swift, slipping over the breaches in the ice like wind over bumps on the ground. Jonius, however, immediately found himself in trouble. His very first step sank through the ice with a splash. He let out a cry and retracted his foot, but the damage was done. The crack gaped open as the ice tore apart, growing dark, watery arms and legs. He slipped, and when he landed on the floating chunk of ice, it flipped, dumping him headlong into the icy lake. Anise hissed a curse. Arch and Dietrich both stopped and turned, and were about to head back, but Anise shouted, "I command you to get to shore!" When they hesitated, she growled. They turned tail and ran. Anise stepped as lightly as she could to the edge of the chasm that had opened up in the ice, dropping to her knees to scan the lapping water for signs of movement. A hand shot from the water, grasping for something to hang on to. Anise grabbed it, shocked at how— there was no other word for it. Warm, Jonius's skin was, despite being in the icy waters. She tried to pull him out, but his fingers were wet and slippery, and the ice offered little purchase for her feet and knees. He sank back in, clawing at the ice. Anise went in after him, grabbing for his armour, which shone like a beacon now that the sun was piercing the water. The moment she sank beneath the lake's surface, she thought she'd gone into shock. Where she'd expected water as cold as melted snow, she instead got lukewarm bathwater. Still, it was dangerous, the current threatening to suck them beneath the ice, the water soaking her clothes and pulling her into the depths. The knight was in even worse shape, sinking far too fast, his armour like an anchor. Her fingers closed around the lip of his chest plate, and she kicked as hard as she could, reaching for the sparkling surface with her other hand. Crack! Her knuckles met ice, pain shooting through her hand. She nearly dropped Jonius, but managed to cling to him, searching the underside of the ice for the breach they'd entered through. She saw nothing but a shimmering blue-white ceiling in all directions. Her lungs heaved, desperate for air. Jonius became her anchor, threatening to pull her below even as he writhed and kicked. There! She finally spotted the hole in the ice, slightly brighter than the rest of the surface, like a real diamond in a pile of impostors. The current had pulled them much further than she expected, a sucking force of nature.
Go,
she urged herself, kicking for that diamond, fighting her clothes and the pull of the strangely warm water and the anchor dragging her down, down, down. Bubbles burst from her lips, the last of her air expelled as her lungs tried to force her to breathe, not knowing there was nothing for them outside of certain death. Her chest screaming, she reached for that hole in the ice. The frozen air was a shock as it met her wet skin, pricking like hundreds of needles. Her face burst from the water, her throat sucking in a tunnel of icy air, burning beautifully the whole way down, filling her lungs. The currents tore at her, but she managed to grab the edge of the ice, where two sets of strong hands clutched her, pulling her skyward. The fingers on her other hand ached, hooked like claws around the edge of Jonius's armour, but she refused to let go, refused to weaken, even as his weight truly became an anchor as he emerged from the water. And then her fingers were pried from his armour and she was airborne, slung over a hard back, the world tipping until she could see nothing but a sodden grey sky, webs of sunlight splintering through a crack in the clouds, like a reflection of the shattered ice below. spots dancing before her vision. She was dimly aware of the ice creaking and groaning, and the jostling of heavy footsteps made heavier by the weight they carried.
"Hurry,"
a voice said. "Archers. We need fire, or they'll freeze to death." "Get her out of these wet clothes," Dietrich replied, the world spinning once more as she was placed on the ground, the cold, cold, snow-blanketed ground. She tried to protest, but her throat felt constricted, only the thinnest stream of air squeezing through. Gentle hands probed at her clothing, peeling them away, one layer at a time. Her eyes found Archer's, which were haunted but determined. She found her voice.
"Junius?"
she croaked. He spat up a bunch of water, but now he's breathing. Dietrich is taking care of him.
"Good. That is good."
Another gulp of icy air. The needles in her skin were getting worse, probing into her bones, trying to carve her apart.
"You disobeyed my command,"
she rasped. His eyes were moist. "I disobeyed my sister, and you're the only one I have, so I wasn't about to let you die."
"I thought you wanted to be king."
"I do," he said, "but not like this. Not if it meant you wouldn't be by my side." He was down to the last layer, but as he peeled it away, he replaced her underclothes with a warm, dry blanket. So caring, so thoughtful. It almost made her feel ashamed at stealing his throne. Still, the cold pressed in, surrounding her, chasing away her thoughts. Her eyelids suddenly felt heavy. "Don't fall asleep," Arch said, pinching her cheek. She barely felt it, because she was so warm now, so warm, so warm, so warm. "Anise? Anise? 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 Anise?" The voice was so distant now that it might have been calling from one of the stars. Sleep was good. So good. Anise felt as if she could sleep and never wake up. So she did. She slept. 26. The Northern Kingdom, Darin. Terin Shiri. For a while, the feeling of dread had intensified, growing stronger and stronger as Terin tried to sleep. Eventually he rose, heading for the forge to see if Fay was still awake. He needed a distraction, anything, to take his mind off of whatever danger Anise was in. Even if he trusted her capabilities, he still worried. He found Fay right where he expected to, except she was asleep on a bench, her hands curled under her head. The largest forge still glowed with molten embers, pulsing like a living, breathing creature in the dark. Several more pieces of huge armor hung cooling on a rack, a gauntlet, a greave, a shinplate. He sighed and headed back out into the night. Just because he couldn't sleep on this night didn't mean others should be forced to endure the same. With no particular purpose in mind, he passed through the quiet, snow-wrapped city streets, marveling at how the night changed everything, almost like a disguise. The stone city had turned from nondescript grey to jet black. Even the blade-like spires of the castle were as dark as shadows, piercing the sky, which had been granted what would most likely be a brief reprieve from the incessant snowfall. Terin felt like he was wearing a disguise, too. Anyone who saw him now would call him the Lord Commander, bowing slightly, their mannerisms full of reverence. But was that really who he was? Could a title and a few barked commands really chase away the true monster that lived in his core? The monster laughed, a sound like knives scraping against stone. And yet better than its usual screams of bloodthirsty glee. He emerged from the city onto the snowfields, frowning. Not because he disliked what he saw, but because he was surprised how good everything looked. Their preparations were nearly complete. Even the war machines were in place and stocked with ball and oil, torches ready to be lit, projectiles ready to be launched. The men had performed remarkably well.
"Too bad it won't be enough,"
he murmured aloud, letting the wind steal his words, his doubts, and take them away to another place where they couldn't haunt him.
"If that's what you think, then why don't you leave?"
a voice asked, startling him. Nearby, a shadow shifted. white teeth grinning in the dark. A tiny pinprick of fire pierced the night, tendrils of wispy grey smoke rising from the end of the pipe.
"You weren't supposed to hear that,"
Terin said. He approached Creek, who didn't rise to bow to him, didn't offer the same reverence and fear most of the other men did. Something about the man's irreverence was refreshing.
"Don't matter,"
the man said.
"I did hear it, and words are just words, as numerous as flakes of snow. And I can squish them under my boots the same way. You won't tell the other men?"
Creek laughed, breathing out a puff of smoke.
"I won't. Not that it makes a difference."
"Why is that?"
"They're all thinking the same thing."
He laughed again, slapping his knee, eventually having to pull the stem of his pipe from his mouth so he could cough for a minute.
"Then why are any of you still here?"
Terin asked.
"If we all believe the situation is so dire, why don't we all get the frozen hell out and live to fight another day? And then I can stop being a fool and go find Anise."
The old man took another drag from his pipe, contemplating the question. Then said,
"I'm not really here for the food."
He shifted position, straightening one leg, the joint popping.
"Truth be told, I'm not even much of an eater."
Terin gaped at him.
"Then why? Why do I keep talking about food?"
Terin nodded.
"Because it means something else,"
he sighed.
"When I talk about food, what I really mean is my wife."
"I didn't know you were married."
He nodded, glancing up at the sky.
"She was a real beauty, my Greta. Not sure how she picked me, but I wasn't about to question her decision. We had a good life, even in a world without a lot of goodness. She died 5 years ago, but it could have been yesterday. I can still see her face."
"I'm sorry," Terin said.
He was. He couldn't imagine the one he loved dying.
"It's fine,"
Creek said.
"I'll see her again one day."
"You believe that?"
It was strange talk for a northerner.
"Aye. Why not? We all need hope, and she's mine.
And she's why you stay in a city that's about to be sacked. She's your food."
He shrugged.
"Something like that. It's not that she's buried here, though she is, but that we lived our whole life here. My happiest memories are in this city. The day after she passed on, I joined the army. They laughed at me on account of my age, but they needed bodies, so they didn't refuse me. I would do whatever it took to protect this place."
Terin stared at him.
"Don't you be looking at me like that. I ain't no hero."
"There aren't any heroes,"
Terin said, but just as quickly regretted it. Just because he was the villain in his own story didn't mean others had to be.
"Are you good?"
Creek asked, tilting his pipe in Terran's direction. Terin considered it. The feeling of dread had passed. Whatever had happened to Anise, she was safe again, at least for now.
"I'm good."
Terin stood and began to walk away, but stopped on the outskirts of the city. Turned around.
"Thank you," he said.
Creek only took another drag from his pipe, sending a cloud drifting into the sky. The smoke met the first of thousands of lazy snowflakes descending from the sky. For some reason, the scene struck Terin as utterly beautiful.
Beautiful like her.
A horrifying thought sprang into his head.
"Wait. Does Anise know a part of you is inside her?"
he asked the monster. The monster cackled with glee.
"She will," it said. "She will."
27. The Hinterlands. Anise Garrick.
"Anise."
The voice was a hiss in the dark, long and drawn out.
"Anise."
And yet as clear as if it was shouted directly into her ear. It was not Sir Jonius, or Archer, or Sir Dietrich. Then who?
Anise, you are alive.
Good to know, she thought. Something soft and warm whispered against her skin, tucked all the way under her chin. And for a second she was back there, trapped under the ice, being dragged into the abyss by a swift current and the dead weight of a knight in full plate. No! she shouted, clawing at the warm water, trying to fight through it, to breach the surface, to breathe. Please, just let me breathe! Strong hands grasped hers, and a voice said, You are safe now, Your Highness. This voice she knew. She opened her eyes to find Sir Dietrich holding her hands between his, tenderly. He was on his knees, and such was his position that, from afar, he might be mistaken for praying.
The water!
she gasped. You escaped, he confirmed. She remembered. The water had pushed at her lips, and her lips had wanted to open, had desperately wanted to drink. And Sir Jonius...
Jonius?
She said. He awoke a while ago, but is sleeping again. He is shaken, but well enough. Anise's eyes found a pile of blankets nearby. They swelled and shrunk as the night breathed somewhere beneath them. She glanced back at Dietrich, and then at their hands clasped together, and he quickly released her.
Thank you, she said, for coming back, for comforting me now.
You're not angry?
No.
I suppose I can give you these back, then. He slid her boots toward her. She laughed, but then cut off suddenly when she realized what she was wearing. Nothing. Only a nest of blankets covered her nakedness. A fire crackled happily nearby. The snow melted in a wet circle around it.
My clothes?
Just about dry by now, Dietrich said, grinning.
Wipe that look off your face.
It's just my face, Dietrich said. If anything, his grin grew broader.
Then cut it off.
The smile vanished.
A jape,
Anise said.
Then casually, Who removed my clothes?
Dietrich winked. She reached for her boot.
Your brother,
the knight said, scooting back and holding up his hands. He was very respectful about it, and I turned away to tend to Sir Jonius. I swear it. She laughed. Something echoed her mirth, but deeper, more snake-like.
What the frozen hell?
Anise.
She shook her head, and the voice faded. Had she swallowed too much lake water? Had the loss of oxygen addled her mind?
No. But now you know.
What?
Anise said aloud.
Know what?
Dietrich looked at her strangely.
I was just saying how Jonius informed us of the unusual water. How it is warm. That explains the melting ice. The prince is down by the lake, feeling it for himself.
Anise blinked. Right. The water.
Yes. I felt it, too.
There was snow on the ground, meaning the temperature was freezing, and yet the water had felt as warm as bathwater.
It doesn't make sense. The hinterlands are a frozen wasteland. Frozen lake should be, well, more frozen.
Dietrich nodded. His lips moved as he said something else, but Anise didn't hear it. All she heard was that whisper in her mind.
You know what Terran hears.
Despite the warmth of the fire and the blankets wrapped around her, Anise shivered. And she knew. She knew. The voice was Terran's monster. Anise had requested more sleep, and Dietrich had gone off to help Arch gather water down by the lake. But Anise wasn't sleeping. No. She was trying to communicate with that voice in her head. The voice that had now disappeared, as if it never existed at all.
Did I imagine it?
Anise wondered. She thought perhaps this might be her way of coping with Terran's departure, a way of connecting with him on some level.
Hello? Monster? Are you there?
When nothing responded, she sighed, feeling foolish. Then again, Terran had told her that the monster came and went as it pleased. And if it was somehow inside her, was it going to change her too, the way it had Terran?
For her own sanity, she opened her eyes and glanced at her arm. Her skin was pale, but not unusually so, not like the chalk-white complexion Terin bore. And her veins were hidden, not black and raised. No. So far she was unchanged. She almost felt awful for the relief she felt. She wondered what Terin must feel all the time. She wondered whether she'd tried hard enough to understand what he was feeling. "Is it my fault?" he left. "Did my ignorance chase him away? If I had delved deeper into what he'd been through, what he was going through, could I have changed his mind?" She sat up, pulling the blankets around her, gritted her teeth. "No," she breathed. She couldn't think this way, couldn't second-guess, couldn't doubt. She was the queen, and she had to move forward. Terin was gone. She might never see him again, and that voice inside her was, "Yes. Oh, yes. You are interesting. More interesting than that armored hunk of flesh you can't stop thinking about." Anise froze. "How is this possible?" "When, on the battlefield, your blood mixed with his, with Terin's, I slipped inside you." Her cold shock turned to hot anger. "How dare you! You ripped us apart! You ruined everything!" "I saved him. There would have been no us, no everything to destroy." The truth was a slap in the face. She told Terin as much herself. She took a deep breath, refocusing her energy. She needed information. "How can you be in both of us at once?" she asked.
"I don't know."
Not helpful. "Is he hearing this conversation?"
"No."
"What does he hear? How does this work?"
"He hears nothing except what I tell him. All I can pass to him are your most powerful emotions. Fear, love, agony, sorrow."
The thought of weighing Terin down with any of those things tightened Anise's chest. "Does he know about this? That you are talking to me? That you are with me?" A purr.
"Yes. He knows."
Shite. Terin already hated himself for, while in the throes of his bloodlust, hitting her. If he also knew his monster had somehow slipped a part of itself into her. She tried not to think about it. There was no point in thinking about it.
"Will you change me?" she asked, holding her breath.
"That's for you to decide,"
it hissed. She felt the moment the monster slipped away, disappearing like an eel into an underwater hideaway. There was no doubt in her mind. The monster would return.
28. The Northern Kingdom, Castle Hill. Sir Christoph Metz. The men were laughing at him, that much he knew. It hurt sometimes, but Sir Christoph Metz was used to it. His entire life he'd been laughed at. He didn't take offence, however, for he knew most people were afraid of what they didn't understand. They only japed to make themselves feel better. Christoph hated japes, hated dry humour, hated sarcasm. He didn't understand why someone would say something that wasn't real, hiding secrets between their words like lies whispered on the wind. And these men he'd been charged to train liked to joke quite a lot. The latest was some absurd story about the time the Ice Lord walked into a tavern, and how his heart had melted from the heat of the fire whiskey or some such nonsense. Instinctively, Christoph knew the story wasn't true, that the Ice Lord hadn't truly become made of ice until he'd drunk Darkspell's monster potion and fought them in the castle. He also knew fire whiskey wasn't actually made of fire. However, when he tried to point these errors out to the soldiers in training, they laughed, shaking their heads. He liked the women better, however. They were more serious about the training, watching him with keen, observant eyes, and mimicking his motions with precision as they learned how to wield a sword in combat. It was unusual seeing women training with swords, but then again the Queen and her aunt, Lady Zelda, who was now the Queen Regent,
had fought bravely against her uncle in order to retake Castle Hill. And anyway, once he got used to seeing them dressed in tight-fitting garb, moving and whirling, parrying each other's swords, he got past the fact that a few of them made him stir inside something fierce. One of the most attractive ones, her hair black, her eyes green, her eyebrows sharp and thin, her nose small and well-shaped, approached him now, sheathing her dull-edged practice sword. "Don't let them get to you," she said. Sir Metz's heart pattered in his chest. These feelings had always been strange to him, and when he had them, he usually found his mouth dry and his senses trembling. "Get to me? Why would they get to me?" She laughed softly, a beautiful, musical tone, and though Christoph hadn't intended it as a jape, he found himself glad he'd said it. "I only meant they can be mean, but they shouldn't be. You're doing a fine job training us." Those green eyes, sparkling as she met his. He looked away. Direct eye contact had always been hard for him. It almost felt like he was being touched, which was even worse. If he could choose between being touched by a human hand — hands touched all kinds of things, and were almost always dirty, even if they'd just been cleaned — or have a thousand spiders crawl over him, Christoph would take the spiders. "I know," he said, and she laughed again.
"Have you ever held back something that was in your head?" she asked.
Her hand was still gripping her sheathed sword, and the pose, the way her hips sat atop her legs, the lines of her arms, the way the sun hit her jawline just right, seemed to make his blood run a little faster through his veins, though he knew that was quite impossible. "Why would I do that?" he asked, frowning. She raised one of those delicate eyebrows, paused, and then said,
"After training today, can you help me with the basic dueling positions?"
He couldn't say anything but, "Yes."
"Thank you."
She strode away, back to her training partner. By then the brief break was over, and the men had finally stopped laughing at his expense. He took them through the drills, correcting errors in their positioning until they were more precise in the angles of their swords and the placement of their feet. Still, even after 3 hours, they were far from perfect, something that rubbed on Christoph's nerves. If it was up to him, he would stop the sun from sinking below the horizon, so they could train for a few hours more, until they were up to his standards. But, of course, that was impossible, and he didn't like to waste time on foolish hopes and dreams. It didn't help that new recruits continued to arrive each day, having heard about the open call to join the Queen's army. Lately, most of them were women, a steady flow of femininity and strength that seemed to bother some of the men, who muttered inappropriate things under their breaths. When Christoph heard such nonsense, he punished them with kitchen duty, polishing armour, though that hardly felt like punishment to him, or scrubbing leathers. On occasion, one of the women would take offence to something one of the men had said, and he would punish them, too. All of his soldiers were treated equally, as it was meant to be, even the green-eyed beauty now approaching him once more as the rest of the men and women headed for the barracks to get cleaned up and locate supper. He knew the woman's name, Private Sheary, as he knew all of his soldiers' surnames. Remembering names had always come easily to him, just as easily as remembering numbers or facts or anything else most people considered useless. But to Christoph it wasn't useless. It was order. He created order from chaos, like setting up a bunch of fallen-over boots in a perfect line. It was only this order that allowed him to remain calm in a world that always seemed to be changing. Christoph also liked making connections between things, like how when the wind blew from a certain direction, at a certain time of year, at a certain speed, it almost always meant a storm was brewing. He could pretty much predict the timing and intensity of a storm down to the day, if not the hour. Another example was the name of the woman who now stood before him expectantly, as if waiting for him to say something. Her surname, Sheary, was the same as that of Terin Sheary, the armoured knight who'd left Castle Hill in secret a while ago. He tried not to fault the man for shirking his duty, especially after how hard he'd fought for his queen, but it was hard for him not to. His thoughts spilled to his mouth, as they often did. "Are you related to Terin Sheary?" The woman blinked. He'd surprised her. "Not that I know of," she said. "I was born in Blackstone, grew up there. When my parents died several years back, my auntie raised me. She died a year ago, and I've been making my own way in the world ever since."
"Oh." She stared at him, like she expected him to say something else.
"But what?"
After a brief silence, where he could feel her eyes on his, where he directed his stare to her earlobe, which was quite nice, Christoph noted, for an earlobe, she said, "Are you ready?"
"For what?"
The edge of her lip quirked.
"To help me with my basic positions. Remember? Like we agreed before."
"Of course I remember," he said. And then, "First position." She flinched, as if surprised by his barked command. Though she shouldn't have been, Christoph thought. The whole thing had been her idea in the first place. She unsheathed her sword and assumed the position. Badly. Christoph cringed. Her feet were all wrong, the angle of her sword so poorly placed that an enemy strike would rattle it right out of her hands. She was looking him in the eyes, Christoph noticed, which was the one right thing she was doing. An enemy's eyes were the windows to predicting his next move. In fact, combat was the only time Christoph ever managed to look anyone in the eyes for an extended period of time. He talked her through her mistakes.
"Widen your stance. No, wider. Yes, that's correct. Now your feet are off center. Good. Better. Still not perfect, though. Now your sword. Lift it by a hand. A little higher. Yes. Straighten it out. Straighter. No, no, no."
Private Sheary threw her sword down in frustration.
"You know, you could be a little nicer about it," she muttered, bending down to retrieve her sword from off the packed snow.
Christoph licked his lips, which he knew was a bad habit, especially in the north where his saliva would likely freeze.
"I was just being honest," he said.
She took a deep breath.
"I know. I'm sorry. I feel like I'm falling behind the other women."
"And the men," Christoph chimed in.
"Thanks," she said.
"For what?"
"I was being droll."
"Oh, I hate droll."
"Maybe if you helped me," she said, stepping closer, too close, too suffocatingly close.
Christoph stepped back. He could breathe again. He said,
"I am helping you."
Her eyes narrowed slyly, and she said,
"No, I mean help me. Like move my arms where you want them to go. My legs, my hips, that sort of thing."
"I..." His mother always told him to choose his words carefully, so he wouldn't come across as rude. But Christoph had never really understood what she meant. He only knew one way to explain things. Directly.
"I'd rather not."
He managed to meet her eyes for a bare moment, and he saw something flicker in them, though he couldn't discern what. This time it was she who looked away.
"I'll get cleaned up."
She started to leave.
"But I thought you wanted help with the basic positions. We haven't even finished with the first one yet."
She turned back.
"It's fine. Really."
"I'm sorry," he said, though he wasn't certain what he was apologizing for. However, he suspected he'd offended her in some way, unintentionally. Private Sheary frowned.
"I don't know what to make of you."
"Make?" Her amused smile was back, and Christoph realized how much he preferred it to that other, shadowed look.
"I don't understand you."
"The feeling is mutual," Christoph muttered. She breathed out an airy laugh, shaking her head.
"Shall we continue?"
"Yes. First position." Christoph wasn't certain what he was feeling, exactly. Private Sheary had improved her basic positions, but she was still far from perfect. Yet, all things considered, it had been a fine day, as far as days went. It had been a week since his queen had departed with the others on their mission to the hinterlands, and he finally felt like he was settling into a good routine. He sat on the bench in his private captain's quarters and got to work. After a few minutes of hard polishing, his armor was gleaming.
In fact, he could see his own wobbly reflection in it, the dark shadow of red-brown stubble on his chin and cheeks. He would have to shave before bed, and then again in the morning. The captain of the Queen's army couldn't look sloppy. He needed to set a good example for his soldiers, both men and women. Though, from experience, Christoph knew most would have stopped polishing at this point. He did not. No, he sought out the nooks and crannies, the secret places where dirt and grime liked to hide, to fester, to build up. He polished until his forearms burned, his dirty cloths piling up beside him. He polished until his armor was perfection. And then he polished some more, just to be certain. His brother, Giordo, had been just a baby when he fell down the well. Christoph, only 8 years old himself, was supposed to be watching him while his mother finished sweeping the floors. Giordo was playing with some rocks behind their house, and anyway, he had only barely learned how to walk. Plus, Christoph had been distracted by the older boys with the wooden swords play-fighting nearby. He forgot about Giordo, watching as the boys moved, how they shifted their feet, the positions of their swords, counting their strokes. Christoph focused his attention on the boys who were winning, soaking in their movements like a sponge drawing water from a washbasin. Learning. Wishing he didn't have to watch his brother, so he could join in the fun. His brother, he remembered with a hint of alarm. How long had he left him alone? The sun hadn't moved much overhead, so it could only have been a few minutes. Still, Christoph raced back, calling, "Giordo! Giordo!" He found the rocks scattered nearby, but the baby was nowhere to be seen. Christoph whirled around, searching the yard for any sign of his brother, but nothing moved. Nothing breathed. Not even Christoph. "The house," he told himself, feeling foolish. Either the baby had gone back inside on his own, or, more likely, his mother had come out and found Giordo alone, so she'd taken him. Oh, boy, Christoph knew he was going to get in big trouble for leaving the baby like that. He willed it to be true, wanting to get in trouble, because that would mean his brother was safe. His mother was still sweeping, her back to him. Giordo wasn't there, the floor empty. Christoph backed out quietly, thinking, panicking, desperately searching the yard for any clue he might have missed. Then he saw it, his breath rushing out of him in a gasp. The well. The bucket, which he definitively remembered resting on the circular stone ledge, was gone. He raced over, giving up any idea of keeping this a secret as he screamed, "Giordo!" He barely heard the door slam as, presumably, his mother came outside to see what the commotion was all about. He reached the well, slamming into its stone side, heaving his head over the lip, staring down into the inky gloom. Dark, so dark. The sound of moving water lapping against the sides, the long rope, slick with moisture, trailing into the shadows. And then a whimper. "Giordo! Giordo!" A spluttering scream and more splashing. "I'm going to save you," Christoph called. A promise to his brother. A promise to himself. He yanked at the rope, hauling it as fast as he could, watching as the tin bucket emerged from the dark, spilling water from its edges, tear-like drops cascading below. Save for the water, the bucket was empty. "No, no, no, no!" His mother arrived just then, her face awash with fear, having realized what had happened. She grabbed the bucket, tossing the water out while shouting, "Get in, Christoph!" He didn't hesitate, fully understanding the situation and the only solution, the only hope they had left. The moment he squeezed into the too small bucket, his mother began lowering it into the darkness, the air around him growing colder with each passing moment. He craned his ear, listening for his brother's whimpering, listening for his splashes, listening for anything to tell him there was still time. Please, let there be time. Toward the bottom, the pace of his descent slowed, and the bucket hit the water with a soft goosh sound. He looked around him, his eyes slowly adjusting to the dark. "Where is he? Where is he? Where is he?" There! Small pale fingers drifting beneath the dark. He grabbed them, pulling, feeling the wet hand slipping from his, falling away, submerging. He dunked his entire head, shoulders, and arms, reaching blindly into the murky water,
finding nothing. And then Giordo.
Bubbles exploded from Christoph's mouth as he tried to scream his brother's name, pulling him up, 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 grasping him under the arms, hauling him into the bucket where there was barely room for either of them. His brother's eyes closed.
No, they need to open. Please open them. Screaming something to his mother, who got the message and began hauling the bucket up. But his brother wasn't breathing. Giordo, you have to breathe. You have to try. You can't die. Please don't let him die.
As they ascended, Christoph held his brother's limp body and counted his own heartbeats, for Giordo had none to count. Christoph awoke, soaked in sweat, lying in his bed in his captain's quarters. Someone was knocking on his door, loudly, hammer blows that seemed to go through the door and directly into his skull, which was pounding with a headache.
He's already gone. Too late. The past can never change. The past can only try harder, save them all, change the future.
The words streamed through Christoph's head, as they always did after one of his nightmares that weren't nightmares but memories, a decade-old past that could never be altered. Giordo is dead, he reminded himself, the truth steadying him, slowing the raucous pounding in his skull.
Coming, he said, sliding out of bed.
His pristinely polished armor was laid out perfectly, ready to be donned as part of his morning routine. But this was decidedly not part of his routine, this caller hammering his door before first light. He slung a cloak over his shoulders, unconsciously trying to smooth out the wrinkles, though there were few, as he strode to the door, pulling it open. A woman stood at the door. He blinked. Private Cheery. Her pale cheeks were flushed pink, her dark hair frosted with snow.
"Good morning," she said.
"Good morning," he replied.
"A stream has arrived in the night. The Queen Regent asked me to fetch you."
"Oh? Where is it from? Who is it to? What does it say?"
Christoph rattled off. He hoped he hadn't missed anything pertinent. He hated having to ask more questions.
"Can I come in?"
she asked.
"No. And you didn't answer my questions. A question is never an answer to a question."
She raised her eyebrows.
"Fine. I shall stand out in the cold."
She hugged herself, shivering slightly. But Christoph thought it looked rather staged.
"You're not out. You're in the corridor. And it's not particularly cold, especially when compared to the actual outside."
"So I truly can't come in?"
"It wouldn't be appropriate," Samet said. "Nor would I want your dirty boots on my floor."
He almost said it, but his mother's admonitions about not being rude stopped his tongue. For once.
"Because you're my captain."
"Is that a question?"
"Not really."
"Good."
"So are you coming with me to see the Queen? She's waiting."
"Yes, but you haven't answered my questions."
I don't know. Does that cover it?"
"Yes," he said. "Thank you."
Then he shut the door. He turned toward the washbasin, but there was another knock at the door. He opened it. Private Cheery scowled at him.
"You shut the door?"
"Yes. Our conversation was finished, was it not?"
"In my face."
It was Christoph's turn to frown.
"I'm fairly certain that's impossible."
"You're impossible."
"Now you're just speaking nonsense. I am right here, which makes me entirely possible."
She huffed.
"You can find your own way to Lady Zelda," she said.
"That's true," Christoph said, once more closing the door.
"Strange girl."
And yet he couldn't help but to find her incredibly appealing. More than once he'd had the strange urge to touch her hair, a thought that made him want to cut off his own hand before he tried. He shuddered once, and then went back to getting ready for the day.
"We received a stream in the middle of the night," Lady Zelda said.
"I know, Queen Regent," Christoph said. "Private Cheery told me."
Private Cheery stood nearby, refusing to look at him.
"Strange girl," he thought again.
Lady Zelda wore a frizzy fur cape across her broad shoulders. She balanced a plate of breakfast across her knees. She wasn't sitting on the throne, but next to it. On the floor. Christoph tried not to stare. Lady Zelda said,
"The private also said you were quite rude to her."
Christoph glanced at Private Cheery, and her cheeks flushed. Christoph said,
"I might have been. I'm not sure. Mother always said I struggled with social niceties."
Private Cheery's eyes met his, and he was forced to look away, but not before seeing the shadow of a smile that ghosted across her face. Something about that smile made his heart pitter-patter a little faster, a fact that bothered him. Smiles should not affect automatic bodily activity. Zelda waved away the topic with a hand gripped around an exceptionally thick slice of buttered toast.
"It's fine. Captains should be tough with their underlings. I respect that. Back to the stream we received.
Where is it from? Who is it to? What does it say?" Christoph asked.
Zelda chuckled, flecks of toast flying from her lips. She licked them off and bit into a hard-boiled egg. Christoph's stomach began to rumble. He was supposed to be eating breakfast now, not watching someone else eat it.
"It's from Darin to me. More specifically, from the blacksmith woman, Fay. Do you remember her?"
"Of course.
Why wouldn't I?" he added in his head, proud of himself for keeping that thought from spilling from his lips.
"Some believe she left with Taryn Cheery."
"Yes," Zelda said, smiling.
She licked her fingers, an act that chased away Christoph's appetite. Human saliva was something he detested. He detested a lot of things, but spittle was definitely near the top of the list. He managed to keep his expression neutral as Zelda continued, though he couldn't stop looking at those spit-moistened fingers.
"And it turns out she did. Her stream states that Taryn Cheery is now the temporary Lord Commander at Darin, as Lord Darin himself has fled the castle. They are preparing for war. They expect the Easterners assembled at Crow's Nest to descend from the cliffs before the next full green moon, if not earlier."
Christoph said nothing, waiting for her to continue. Instead, she bit into an apple, crunching loudly. He hoped the fruit had been washed. Thoroughly. Lady Zelda placed the apple back on the plate, which meant it touched the leftover egg and toast crumbs. Christoph cringed. He hated when food touched. It wasn't as bad as saliva, but still.
"Fay also requested any assistance we could provide," Zelda said. "She stated that without assistance, they will likely all perish during the battle."
Christoph straightened up. Darin needed their help.
"We are early on in our training still, but I can have several of the more prepared groups leave at once. I will leave training instructions behind for everyone else, and when I return, we shall continue."
"No,"
Zelda said.
"No? I don't understand."
She shook her head.
"While I am sympathetic to their plight, we simply can't afford to send any men at this time. We are in the rebuilding stage, and defending Castle Hill must be the priority."
"They will all die," Christoph said, "including Taryn Cheery."
Zelda closed her eyes, reopened them slowly. There was no mistaking the look of sadness that pulled at the edges of her eyes.
"These are hard times. We all must make sacrifices for the greater good. Lord Commander Cheery and his soldiers will help give us the time we need to defend ourselves. With luck, Anise will be back with our army before the Easterners reach Castle Hill."
Christoph simply could not accept that. No. Whenever he saw someone in need, someone he could save, everything else seemed to fall away and he was in that well again, was watching his brother's fingers slip beneath the water, was watching the life drain out of his kin.
"Because of me. My fault. All my fault."
That was why he counted the number of people he had saved. 174. It wasn't nearly enough. But he hoped one day the number would be enough to make up for the one boy he couldn't save. Jordo. And yet his honour made it impossible for him to refuse to obey an order from the Queen Regent. Luckily, he had a plan around that.
"So I cannot send any of my men to Darin?" he asked, just to make things clear with Private Sheary as his witness.
"Correct. I'm sorry. Training will continue as planned. But I wanted you to be aware that Darin will soon be under siege. Our